From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast, hosted by Paul Hanley.
Recently, I had the opportunity to speak with Yukon Huang, my colleague at the Carnegie Endowment and a senior fellow in the Carnegie Endowment's Asia program. We discussed U.S.-China economic relations. Yukon's research at Carnegie focuses on China's economy and its regional and global impact. Prior to joining Carnegie, Yukon served as the World Bank's country director for China. Previous to that, he was country director for the Soviet Union. Yukon is still an advisor to the World Bank, as well as the Asia Development Bank and the Asia Infrastructure Bank, along with various governments and corporations. Yukon's also an A-list commentator for the Financial Times on China. During our discussion, Yukon shared his thoughts on major areas of friction in the U.S.-China trade and economic relationship. His latest book, Cracking the China Conundrum, Why Conventional Economic Wisdom is Wrong, explores why some of the usual arguments made about China's economy, political system, and foreign policy is wrong. I would encourage you to check out his book, especially if you find our conversation in this podcast of interest. Thank you for listening to the China in the World podcast. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Yukon. Please be sure to leave us a rating and comment on iTunes, as well as heading to the Carnegie Tsinghua website to see more of the work from all of our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Yukon Huang, thank you very much for joining the China in the World podcast, and thank you for coming to China this week to participate here at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in the 7th Annual U.S.-China Strategic Dialogue between leading American thinkers and Chinese thinkers. Really want to talk to you today about your area of expertise, which is, of course, economics and trade, something you focus on very closely at the Carnegie Endowment. Coming into office, and certainly in the presidential campaign, we heard a lot of concerns about trade. Peter Navarro was a name that came up, and there was great focus on the trade deficit between the United States and China, and a lot of talk about this being sort of at the root of our problems with China in the economics and trade area. We talked looming trade wars. There was a lot of talk about defensive trade enforcement measures, countervailing duties, tariffs, border adjustment tax, all of that. We heard a lot of this. I first want to get a sense from you where you think this concern comes from. Why are so many in the U.S. concerned by this? Why has there been so much tension on this particular topic?
It's a very common public perception that America faces an economic problem because it has the world's largest trade deficit. And of that deficit, 60 to 70% of it is represented by a bilateral deficit with China. So for the ordinary person, even policymakers, it's sort of like common sense would suggest that if I could somehow moderate America's trade deficit with China, that the U.S. would benefit. Growth would be higher. U.S. employment would benefit from the fact that more could be produced domestically. This is also meshed with an observation that feeling that American companies are investing too much abroad. And this is leading to a reduction in manufacturing jobs at home. It increases the competitive advantages of America's competitors overseas who could then produce and export to the United States. And again, the feeling was that this was a China problem.
In terms of looking at approaches to recalibrate the U.S.-China economic trade relationship, is this really where we should be focusing, or is that misguided? I mean, if you look at what just, coming out of Mar-a-Lago, this 100-day plan, right, and what was just recently announced by the U.S., you don't see a lot of that in the results of that. It's more about trade liberalization, it looked to be.
No, and I think that's a good thing, because the Mar-a-Lago, I think, put the dialogue on a better keel. Trade deficits are not really the issue. Bilateral deficits are not really the issue. trade is inherently a multilateral issue because countries produce parts and components. They're assembled here, they're shipped there. What you think is a trade deficit with China may actually be products which are largely produced in Japan or Korea or Taiwan or elsewhere. So that's not the issue. The overall trade balance is an issue. And that's determined actually by a country's savings rates. If they save more than they invest, they have a surplus. If, as happens in the United States, investment needs exceed savings availability, you have a trade deficit. And that deficit in the United States is largely because of budget deficits and households borrowing a lot. It's not really a China issue. But China contributes to this because the reverse is true in China. China is a very strong savings nation, more so than their investment needs are required. The consequence is they run a trade surplus. And that surplus of money then flows outside. A large amount of it comes to the United States. And when it comes to the United States, it lowers interest rates. It sort of like puts a gentle encouragement to governments, corporations, households to borrow more. Mm-hmm. So there are people who say indirectly, China's excessive savings or trade surpluses may actually be causing America to have a little bit more of a trade deficit than might normally be the case. But this is actually not really the issue. The U.S. has been running a trade deficit for 40 years straight. Mm-hmm. And deficits even when China's surpluses are insignificant. So clearly there's no direct relationship. So what is the real issue, however? The real issue happens to be investment flows. Money is flowing all over the world to seeking higher returns. So U.S. companies invest at home, they invest abroad. There's a lot of feeling that a lot is going to China, and that's a myth. Only 1.5% of America's foreign investment actually goes to China. Very little. You know, one of the major reasons is the U.S. is largely a services sector. Mm-hmm. oriented economy. It's mm-hmm. media, it's health, it's education, it's financial services, it's IT, it's wholesale research, retail distribution systems. These are largely services kinds of activities. Mm-hmm. This is America's strengths. And this is where I think America does have a legitimate concern, because China has one of the most restrictive foreign investment regimes, and the greatest bias is in services.
So U.S. investment into China is quite low. You made a point in our discussions through the dialogue that European investment into China is actually growing much quicker, and it's much, much greater than the United States. Why is that?
Well, if you go to stores in China, the malls, you look on the streets, the first thing you notice is that 90% of the products are European. They're manufactured goods, they're retail goods, they're high-end consumer goods. There's transport equipment, trucks, cars. Airbus manufactures in China. That means there's a lot of foreign investment mm-hmm. being done by Europeans. Boeing does not until recently. So it was all mm-hmm. manufactured in the West. So the consequence is there's relatively little U.S. direct investment here compared to European companies, because Europeans are heavily involved in manufacturing, more so than Americans. The American export mix here is agriculture commodities, and then there's a lot of services. So they are, in fact, suffering more from what I call a restrictive investment climate.
And this is important to the United States because this is, as you say, this is where our strength really lies.
Right. And I think this is an area where both sides need to work at it.
And can we expect China in the area of services to liberalize foreign investment going forward? Is this in the realm of possibility?
I think this is potentially easier to do, and the government is more likely to consider this seriously in the coming years than it did before. Because 5 to 10 years ago, when you look at the Chinese economy, they're very weak in the services sector, financial services, IT, entertainment, media, whatever, dominated by a few state enterprises, which were actually not very, very competitive. Today, China has actually some major players.
More competitive.
Mm-hmm. And what we know from experience elsewhere is that if you want these companies, Chinese companies, to actually become more innovative, more competitive, more creative, you need competition.
Sure.
And that's foreign competition, mm-hmm. or even more competition for private Chinese companies. So here it is, China is the most restrictive of any major economy in the world towards services. And opening it up is actually good for China, and obviously clearly good for the United States.
And do you see signs within the Chinese government that this is an area where they're willing to open?
2 or 3 months ago, they signaled this, mm-hmm. an intention to open up certain sectors in the financial areas. in some of the media and other areas, IT, whatever. The question is, will they follow through? Because in the past, these kinds of commitments took a long time before they became a reality, and people questioned whether or not it would actually happen. In the middle of a political transition or change in China, so I don't expect dramatic changes over the next couple of months. But I would actually expect that this time next year, there'll be some very tangible actions to say, yes, we are serious. And some of this showed up in the Mar-a-Lago agreement.
Mm.
Because, for example, the credit card companies.
MasterCard, Visa.
Yeah, they're now should be able to operate fully. But in principle, a couple of years ago, people thought this would already happen. It didn't happen. But now it looks like it is reality going to happen.
And in addition to the investment, sort of increased market access, mm-hmm. greater reciprocity, mm-hmm. Where as China can invest in our economy, we want to invest in their economy and similar sectors. What are the other issues that should be sort of front and center in recalibrating the U.S.-China economic and trade relationship?
Well, generally speaking, what America's asking for, and it sounds very, very commonsensical and fair, is they want equal treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Then when an American company comes into China, it should be treated the same as Chinese companies. And in principle, China agrees. But you have lots of local regulations and others which often don't work very smoothly to this effect. What does China want? China wants to be able to invest in a greater range of activities in the U.S., including companies which have technological advantages that China does not have. And then you get into a security issue. And I would define this technological issue as complicated in the sense that there are technologically sophisticated companies which don't really relate to what I call security concerns. And the U.S. has a very good system, CFIUS, to review these, and it should be reviewed. And those kinds of investments should proceed. And then there are areas where there is obviously security concerns. I think it's legitimate for any country to worry about security aspects of any foreign investment. But you can certainly open up and make it easier for Chinese companies to go into the United States. And in fact, it would make a lot of sense in the United States for more investment to come in.
On trade, you mentioned earlier in this discussion that it's really, at the end of the day, a multilateral issue. The United States led the efforts to put together the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP. A lot of us wanted to see that concluded. But unfortunately, the Trump administration, unfortunately, in my view, pulled onto that on day one. Was this a mistake?
I personally think it was a mistake. It's what most analysts or trade theorists would say is a mistake. I'm still kind of hopeful that maybe a year or two down the line that this TPP might still be resurrected.
As the Trump-Pacific Trade Agreement?
Maybe.
TPP, Trump-Pacific Partnership?
Some things differently, and now it's a good thing.
Right.
I think the countries like Japan or Canada or Australia are still talking about how can we keep this alive. So I don't think it's a dead issue. It may come back. The question then is it in China's interest? Because initially, TPP was seen as something which could be used to contain China. It
right.
wasn't a member.
A tool, actually, in the pivot to Asia, seen as an effort to kind of keep China down, contain it.
And this got caught up in the political rhetoric.
Yeah.
Because in the U.S. political system, some people were actually citing this as a reason to approve the TPP.
Right.
Now, the reality is that if you have some desire to sort of like influence China's economic and trade policies, that's best achieved by having China's part of the agreement.
Mm.
So the logic really would have been, let's move forward with the TPP, set these high standards. And then at some point in time when China has evolved a bit, it would be in its own interest to join. And in fact, that's probably the best of all worlds.
And in fact, we were hearing voices coming out of China in the last couple of years saying exactly that.
Right.
That it would be good for China to aim to achieve it because it could put pressure domestically and push through some domestic reforms that are difficult to achieve
and
in China.
And what you also hear today is somewhat interesting in that people are saying on RCEP. RCEP should actually take some of the policies that are in the TPP.
This is the Regional Comprehensive Economic
Partnership. It doesn't have China, have the United States in there. It has the ASEAN group, India, Australia, Korea, Japan. And the issue is should RCEP now think about some of the so-called good policy initiatives that are in the existing TPP and try to actually incorporate them. I think that'd be a good thing.
How would you describe the differences between TPP and RCEP? I've heard TPP goes behind the border, where the other RCEP is more about tariffs and issues at the border. Is that
yes,
correct?
Tariffs, quotas,
product-specific merchandise trade. TPP gets into intellectual property rights protection. It gets more into rules of origin, labor rights, environmental standards, legal recourse to dispute resolutions. Many of these things are good things.
Yeah.
And the issue, of course, is that Asia is very, very diverse. So whether it's a TPP or an RCEP, the stickiest issue was how do you apply these high standards to a very diverse range of countries, some which can easily meet the highest standards and some which need time. And I say, whether it's an RCEP or TPP, this kind of gradual phasing in of requirements and how it would apply to countries like a Malaysia or even a Vietnam, much less a China also.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a very, both of these are useful devices to sort of like solve a problem. And we need that, of course, because the world is so diverse.
Some had been talking, when TPP was still around for the United States, some were talking about over time RCEP and TPP merging into one broader trade agreement. Is that something that would have been possible?
For economists and trade theorists, this was the ideal. The idea was that you had a TPP process set fairly high standards. You had an RCEP which reached out to a broader range of countries, which some ways some couldn't meet those standards, but they were giving a push in the same direction. And then you had this umbrella of what people call the Free Trade Agreement for the Asia Pacific. This idea was originated by the U.S.
United States, 2007, in Australia.
At that time, China was not interested.
Right.
Okay. 2 years ago, when TPP was rolling along, China resurrected the idea, why don't we go for FTAAP? Because it felt like it was actually being left out of the TPP. So I think
the U.S. didn't like that at the time, right? Because it sort of took away the spotlight from TPP.
Right. They wanted to just, practically speaking, go forward with the TPP. Now we have the very ironic position. The TPP is not out there. So in some ways, those in the United States who are still committed to a broader multilateral trade approach I need to think of a way of sort of like saying, how do we get back on the table?
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And maybe a broad discussion of a free trade agreement with the whole region and some of the things that could be done could be initiated. Now, here, the ideal thing would be that U.S. and China have to realize that in this particular area, it is the interest of both sides.
Hmm.
And how do you get them actually back on the table in a way that I would say doesn't conflict with their political pressures they face at home?
Yeah.
And so I think this is the agenda for the coming years.
I can't let you get away without talking about the Belt and Road Initiative. You can't walk 5 feet in China without seeing something that's related to the Belt and Road. But in the United States, I talk to friends back home, people really don't know anything about it.
Right.
Why is this? How should the United States deal with the Belt and Road Initiative?
Well, you're right. You don't hear anybody talking about the Belt and Road Initiative. If you think about it, because of the fact that the wording is so unusual, it's very Chinese.
Yeah.
You want to build one road,
right?
What does that mean? It sounds like a slogan with no content.
Mm-hmm.
It's largely an
Asia. It's also changed names several times.
Is that right?
It used to be the One Belt, One Road.
Now it's
OBOR.
Now they want to talk about it as a BRI, Belt Road Initiative. I don't like that. It sounds like a company. It no longer has this nice Chinese theme. But initially, the idea is that One Belt, One Road is a unifying principle of integrating half the world, 65 countries, accounting for a huge share of global GDP, ranging from Asia, South Asia, Central Asia, the Middle East, all the way to Europe. So it's basically a link between China and the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
Because they already have very strong trade links across the Pacific, going to Canada, United States, and Latin America. So that's not the issue. The issue is actually broadening that direction. Is this in the U.S. interest? Yes, it is, because any initiative which increases global trade incomes increases the market for everyone else. In fact, the U.S. has had several initiatives in the past focusing on Central Asia and other countries to encourage greater integration.
Right.
So the connectivity infrastructure is the interest of everyone. So what is the view that people should have of the One Belt, One Road Initiative? Because there are many people who are concerned that this may be a so-called strategic endeavor of China.
China's Marshall Plan.
Marshall Plan, but in a negative way.
Mm-hmm.
That this allows them to dominate these countries. It just gives them greater markets. They won't actually, these countries won't benefit in some way. My answer to this question is that the onus is on the countries themselves. They don't have to participate
mm-hmm.
and take a loan. They don't have to move forward with the infrastructure project. But there is money potentially available. And the burden then is, does this make sense for me as a country? Whether I am a Sri Lanka or a Burma or a Pakistan or even in India, does that road, that power project, that logistics initiative, that container system, will that basically improve my link with global markets? If it does, if the cost is reasonable, if my people generate jobs from this and the terms are attractive, why not? But if you are irresponsible and you just think it's going to be a free deal or there's corruption involved, then you may end up incurring more debt and not getting much out of this. So my point would be, here is an opportunity. The Chinese way of looking at these things has always been, if we don't intend to interfere,
they're not going to push politics, something, right? Politics, stay above the politics. Yeah.
It's up to you to decide, because that's the way China's always operated. They basically went to donors or people or whatever and said, if you want to lend us money, we will make a decision as to whether it makes serves our needs. If it doesn't, we don't want it. If we think we can get high returns on it, we'll go forward with this. This is the same philosophy in here. So I think it's really a question of, here's a chance, opportunity. Those who are ready for it, I think, can benefit a lot. And the others need to be fairly careful about this. And if it is so, and remember, this is not something that's going to be finished in 1 year, 5 years.
Right.
It's 20, 30, 40 years.
Yeah.
And then I think in that context, it clearly is a need to unify the rest of Asia to Europe, and everyone would benefit if that actually worked out pretty well.
Well, Yukon Huang, thank you very much for joining us today for the China and the World podcast and for joining us this week in Beijing for the 7th annual U.S.-China Strategic Dialogue.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
That's it for this edition of the Carnegie Tsinghua China and the World podcast. I encourage you to explore our site and see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in next time.